I am Planta on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Wherever you find yourself, a livable and sustainable community is the ideal place to live. One such community exists, built from scratch in and around the Simon Fraser University campus atop Burnaby Mountain. In the mid-1990s, the SFU Community Trust was created with the purpose of developing a model community of both residential and commercial that would liven up the otherwise lifeless SFU outside school hours. University now boasts 5,000 residents with retail and restaurants and elementary school and more. That is a model of sustainable planning and practice. A new book, Building Community, Defining, Designing, Developing University, has just been published. Written by Gordon Harris with Richard Littlemore, the book chronicles how university came to be and its future plans. It could house up to 10,000 people in the foreseeable future. Mr. Harris, who joins me now, talks in the book about the history, about what was there, and how people like Arthur Erickson and Jeff Massey, who are SFU's architects, as well as university presidents Gordon Schramm and Pauline Jewett, envisioned the future. Harris talks about the creation of the SFU Community Trust, his predecessor Michael Geller, and the collaboration with other stakeholders like the province and the city of Burnaby. Gordon Harris is an urban planner, development strategist, and real estate market analyst. He's a lecturer and elected to the College of Fellows of the Canadian Institute of Planners and the College of Fellows of the Royal Canadian Geographical Society. Since 2007, he has been the president and CEO of the SFU Community Trust. This new book is from Echo Tone Publishing. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Gordon Harris. Mr. Harris, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Pretty good. Yourself?
Very well, thanks.
I was telling you just before we started how much I enjoyed the book. I learned a lot. Some people might ask you, why this book? Why now? What do you tell them?
Well, there are a couple of reasons why the book and why now. I think university really is a story that can help others in different communities, different countries, take a more serious look at low-carbon community building. And there are a lot of people involved in the creation of university. And before we all forget who they were, because there's always a tendency to think history starts when we show up, that we should go back in time and make sure that there was a proper acknowledgement of the people whose idea it was originally, the people who helped shape it over decades, and then the people who started to build it. And now we continue to build and are about to finish it soon.
So you're the president and CEO of the SFU Community Trust. When was that established?
The trust was established in 2000, so 18 years ago. And I became the chair, or the president and CEO in 2007, January 2007, taking over from the founding president, Michael Geller.
I see. And so was there a timeline set then in 2000 as to how long this would last, say?
Well, it was always anticipated that it would be at least a 20-year project. And we're pretty close to that now, 20 to 25 years, realistically, to build a complete community on Burnaby Mountain. And we will lease the last of the remaining approved zoned development sites within the next 2 months. And then if you look ahead to how long it will take to build the remaining three buildings, one of them is a very complex mixed-use building on the high street. Let's say that's 3 to 3.5 years before the buildings are finished and we, the trust, have finished the public realm work. So we're all done in 3.5 years, so that will mean that it's been roughly 24 years.
I see. So what surprised me when I'm reading the book, because SFU's been around since the mid-60s, is that it was only until I guess people like Gordon Schramm and Pauline Jewett had talked about something like a development like this, but it wasn't really until the mid-90s that the project picked up steam. Was it simply because there wasn't, say, the need to have people live there at the time, say, in the 60s and the 70s?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The region was much smaller then. Certainly, Arthur Erickson and Jeff Massey imagined that there would be a residential community on Burnaby Mountain from the very beginning when they were planning in the early 60s. By 1971-72, when Pauline Jewett was the president, there was a notion that that was the time to go ahead with the community development. The economy wasn't great at the time, and The next time it was thought to be a good idea was the early 80s. Again, going into a downturn, particularly in the lower mainland housing market, that simply wasn't the time either. And so by the mid-80s, we've had the Brundtland Commission, we've heard the importance of addressing sustainable development, and in the 90s, a new president, John Stubbs, who came from Trent University, where he had successfully negotiated an agreement between the city of Peterborough and Trent University to use university lands in a way that would contribute to the community as well as the university. He then sat down with Burnaby, and that got things rolling. And the 1996 official community plan really set the stage for more detailed planning that became university.
And so right now there are about 5,000 people that live there.
That's right.
And I guess the projection is that it's sustainable for about 10,000, is that right?
Yeah, we think we'll end at between 9,000 and 10,000 people. We will have built all of the zoning permits. We're roughly 500 units short of the maximum we could build. We will be short. And that is development for another day. Certainly after we've done our work, there's still an opportunity to come back and add about 500 units.
In the recent municipal elections, I had Kelvin Gawley on from the Burnaby Now on the show, and one of the transit options that is currently being explored, and you write about it in the book, is a gondola.
Yeah.
And that makes total sense because, when it snows, the roads leading up the hill there to SFU, sometimes they're shut down, buses can't go up. So a gondola makes perfect sense. How far are we along in terms of say, that being a reality, say?
Well, I think it's sooner than it was even a year ago. Mm. I think there is a growing recognition that urban transit gondolas work in cities around the world. They're remarkably cost-effective. They're a greenhouse gas reduction story. And the Burnaby Mountain Gondola is really a piece of a regional transit story. So it would facilitate connections to Vancouver, to UBC, to Surrey. SFU has campuses in Surrey and in downtown Vancouver as well as Burnaby Mountain. And the number of people that are using the shuttle bus between Production Way SkyTrain Station and the mountain, if we could shift those people from buses to the gondola, we take 53% of all the bus traffic off Burnaby Mountain. Mm. So if we're talking about a sustainable community or a low-carbon community, a really good place to start is reducing the carbon footprint of public transit.
Yeah. And they look cool, too. You have I guess, artist renderings in the book. And it just makes sense for a mountain to have that sort of infrastructure, right?
Well, it is one of the safest, most efficient, fastest ways to move large numbers of people. And so a couple of things. One is the obvious speeding up the transit service, allowing people to get up and down the hill more quickly and easily. But also in the event of a fire or anything else on the mountain, and we are surrounded by forests, It's also the quickest way to get a very large number of people off the hill very quickly. You can move 3,000 to 4,000 people an hour off the hill. There is simply no other way to do that.
Yeah. And it doesn't take, as Gordon Shrum envisioned or said, 30 minutes to get from anywhere in Metro Vancouver to SFU now, does it?
No. And that would get you down to Production Way SkyTrain Station in about 6.5 or 7 minutes.
Yeah.
With no queuing.
You mentioned a moment ago that you took over as president and CEO in 2007.
Yeah.
The next year was a great downturn in the economy as well. You write in the book about a lot of the challenges that the SFU Community Trust has faced over these past 18 years. That's something that I got out of the book, is that learning from the mistakes, learning from the challenges really does, inform. And I'm sure that's the sort of stuff that you tell people who ask for advice from around the world, right?
Absolutely, Joe. And one of the really key messages is at the very beginning of the project, and I wasn't there for this part, but I certainly recognize that the people involved were brilliant in their approach, establishing the vision so that it was really clear to everyone what this was going to be. And then equally important, and SFU did this extremely well, was saying why it was important. So in the case of the university, the net proceeds from our development fund an endowment to support teaching and research at Simon Fraser University. And so that's the why we're doing it. It also is animating an otherwise isolated hilltop suburban campus. It's bringing life to the community, to the university. It's providing retail and commercial services that go beyond what the university is able to provide. It's a vibrant community, but its purpose as well was to create endowment wealth. And so we don't shy away from that, that we're very proud of the fact that we're able to support the university directly through its teaching and research.
That's something that I found fascinating in the book is the part of the book where you talk about language and the language that you found useful or that what words to use are important. For example, density and sustainability throughout the last few years have taken on new meanings, haven't they?
Indeed. If everybody has their own definition in their heads of what sustainability is. But we are able to focus more on being a low-carbon community, and I think that resonates for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. But the three words we use most to describe university, it's livable, it's affordable in a very expensive region of the country, it is relatively very affordable, and it's sustainable. So livable, affordable, sustainable. And that really conveys to people who are home buyers what it is they're getting into, and they embrace it. We can talk a lot about the 26 kilometers of trails in the surrounding conservation area, a remarkable elementary school, an elementary school with a curriculum focused on sustainability, the greenest childcare center on the planet. But really, when people are house hunting, they're looking for something that is highly livable, highly affordable, and we roll sustainable into that. And it's a winning combination.
Well, one of the things that is instructive about this book, Building Community, is something that you talk about, and I'm sure this is something that you deal with daily, and your predecessor, Mr. Geller, as well, and that's consultation. I mean, that's key to all the various stakeholders. And so I guess when people ask you from elsewhere advice as to how to, say, develop a project like this, what advice do you give them in terms of how to go about consulting as well as they should?
Well, it certainly is the key to any good planning exercise, planning program, is consultation, and meaningful consultation, not just going out and telling people what you're doing, but engaging them in the process of identifying what should be done, what's the best way to do it, and how can they be involved. And it doesn't stop when you start the project. For instance, next week, our University Community Association is hosting a town hall meeting, and I and others at the Trust and the University have been invited to attend and answer questions. But it's still that process of consultation. They're now more, as a community, consulting with themselves and bringing others like the city and the university and the Trust into their conversation. But absolutely, the importance of consulting with people, listening to them, explaining when you can't do something, why you can't do it, and being open to suggestions that aren't your own.
And so you found in your time there that relations between, say, residents, the university, as well as the powers that be in Burnaby and the Sword and the province, I mean, those have been pretty harmonious, haven't they?
They have been. And that's no accident. That is high-level meetings among the senior administration at the university, mayor and council, and senior staff at Burnaby, and the trust staff on a regular basis for years and years to keep those channels open, to identify areas of common concern, areas where we can help each other. And that is a standing committee of council, and we can certainly look to the now former mayor, Derek Corrigan, and his council for having done a terrific job of keeping us engaged in what they're up to and listening to us and knowing what we're up to. And I see no change coming in that. It's a very important part of the process. The other part is engaging the community itself. And so in the early days, we would meet with the residents on a regular basis. This upcoming town hall meeting is really the first one the community has organized and is hosting, and will be guests. And we're thrilled about that, because as we transition from being an active master developer to wrapping up our work on the project, it really needs to be the community that takes the lead from here on.
And so who makes up the community now? I mean, I mentioned a moment ago it was about 5,000 people. Is that a great cross-section, say, of ages and family groups? I mean, with children, without children, say?
Yeah, it's diverse in many ways. It's a community of young families with young children, largely. About 40, probably closer to 47% of residents have young children living at home. Coincidentally, about the same percentage have a relationship to Simon Fraser University, either as faculty, staff, or students. And of those, probably close to half, or 20% of our population, are students living in the community. Mm-hmm. We have increasing signs that people in the surrounding area, North Burnaby, the North Shore, the Tri-Cities, are downsizing. They're selling large homes and moving up onto Burnaby Mountain. And so we want to encourage that. We're looking at the opportunity of creating seniors housing, active living housing in the community in our last major development site. Mm-hmm. Too early to say if that is going to happen, but we certainly think if it isn't time, it soon will be time for that kind of project.
So if you live if you work or study at SFU, there are enough amenities in the sort, restaurants, shopping, that you don't really have to leave the hill, do you?
No, our high street is pretty complete. In the early days, people told us they wanted an elementary school, they wanted a child care center, they wanted a grocery store, they wanted a medical center, and they wanted a liquor store, and not necessarily in that order. And in 2010, we opened Nestor's Market, a grocery store that is groceries, pharmacy, a deli, and a post office. We opened a liquor store almost 2 years ago, and that's a provincial liquor store. Uh-huh. The elementary school opened also in 2010, the child care center in 2012. And so with the shops and services on the high street, everything from a dentist to sit-down restaurant, some fast food, a hair shop, it's a pretty complete community. The only thing that still hasn't opened is a medical center. We are working on a deal for one, but it's not there yet.
Yeah. The other thing that was interesting in the book was you talk about bringing retail and the sort of considerations that one has to make in terms of what kind of retail. You mentioned Nestor's Market. I mean, I'm sure residents didn't want, say, a big chain. They wanted something local like Nestor's rather than, say, you know, an American-owned chain, for example. The other thing, there is great support that a developer can provide. I guess considerations that they have to make long-term, not just, say, handing over a lease.
Yes, and certainly Nestor's Market, who's been a remarkably supportive corporate citizen in our community from the get-go, they recognized they were coming in well in advance of the market, that until we got to 5,000 people, it was going to be a challenge. They were willing to take that chance, knowing that they'd also still be there when we were somewhere between 9,000 and 10,000 people. Certainly, there was, in the early days, a desire to see small, independent mom-and-pop businesses, not chains. Uh-huh. And while it sounds good, the reality is those are the very retailers who can't afford to wait for the population to show up. Mm. So we had some challenges, some growing pains in the early days. We have tried to stick with local independent tenants where that is appropriate and where we need more bench strength to draw more people to the high street. We have regional and national tenants. They, in fact, support the small independent tenants because they have greater drawing power. And so we have, for instance, we have a Subway in the retail precinct. And there was some resistance to that initially because, oh, we don't need a big multinational Sanders chain.
Yeah.
Well, the reality is it's a franchise owned by the very first retailer we had in the high street, Parminder Parhar. And he was struggling. And he came to us and said, look, I think I'm going to need to do something in order to survive here. Would you support me if I got a Subway franchise? And I said, absolutely. If that's going to keep you in the community, keep you going, thriving as an independent retailer, absolutely. And students and residents voted with their feet. There was a huge lineup when they opened. It continues to do very well. And Parminder continues to serve the university community with his Renaissance Coffee and other shops. So I think that decision, one, helped save a small independent retailer, and it increased foot traffic on our high street dramatically.
I guess that's the other lesson in the book is patience. You must have that in abundance.
You have to have patience. You also have to approach change very incrementally. So, for instance, in the early days, we had green building guidelines. It wasn't until 2010 that we entrenched green building requirements. And I'm convinced that had we started with green building requirements, we might still be waiting for developers to sign on. Mm. But by giving them guidelines, working with them, increasing the requirements over time incrementally, I think we've done two things at once. We've made for a greener, lower carbon community, and we've helped developers overcome whatever fear and resistance they might have had to doing things in a more environmentally responsible way. So I describe what we've created here as profitable sustainability. You know, if it isn't economic, it isn't sustainable. So if people can't do a project and make money, it doesn't matter how sustainable it is. They're not going to do it a second time. So I think we've worked very closely with developers in the region and with retailers and others to ensure that they can do well while doing good. And to me, that really is the key to a complete community, is ensuring that it's not just pretty, it's not just able to tell a single story about low carbon, for instance, but it is able to talk about profitable, successful businesses, developers who have done well while creating wonderful housing in the region at a price point that allows more people into the market. So profitable sustainability is really the key to this.
Gordon, this is a great book. It's a great valedictory for all of you at the Trust, but also it's fascinating for the rest of us to learn about what's going on there in Burnaby Mountain. I appreciate your time today. Thanks for this, and continued good luck with the book.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Building Community, Defining, Designing, Developing University is from Echotone Publishing, written with Richard Littlemore. It's author Gordon Harris. Join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunta.